I want to share this evening with you some of the stories that occurred to my family during the Second World War. And I want to preface it by the way my dad always introduced these stories. He would always say, "I was born in the wrong part of the world, in the wrong time in Earth's history." He was born in Vienna, Austria, then moved after a couple of years to Germany, where his father was a minister and a literature evangelist. And they lived in Frankfurt, Germany, the banking capital of the country. And there they would live throughout the experience of the war years. It was a very difficult time. This is my grandfather, pictured here. My aunt, who lives not very far from here, near Napa, at Pacific Union College, where she was registrar for many years, and her husband, my uncle, was chair of the physics department there for many years. Bill Mundy wrote this book some years ago about our family story, and along with Malin Schirsch, who polished it up a little bit. My grandfather served during this time in the Second World War because he was forced to. And I will share with you some of the experience of that as we go along. But I want to draw the background first with you today, because sometimes it's difficult for people to think or imagine how individuals could have allowed something like the Nazi regime to take part or to become powerful in that part of the world. The reality is that it happened through a democratic process. And it happened after a series of very devastating blows came to the German people, first with the loss of World War I, then with the Great Depression that hit in 1929 when banknotes and currency were devalued and people were walking through the streets with wheelbarrows filled with cash to buy one loaf of bread. People were without work, people without jobs, and in the midst of all of this, you had communism, you had socialism, you had various political parties that were advertising themselves and were offering a new hope for Germany. And this is my family. My grandfather and my grandmother are the young people sitting there holding their children on their laps. That's my grandfather, Franz, on the right, and my grandmother, Helena. And my dad is the young boy to the right, sitting on his dad's lap. Kurt, the oldest in the family, is between the two parents. And Lotte, who lives in Southern California now, I'm going to see her at the end of this month. We have a big family reunion at her house. She goes by Lisa. Lotte was difficult in this country, so she changed her name to Lisa. She married an American GI after the war and moved to this country and has been living in Southern California for all of her life since she moved here. She's sitting on her mother's lap. And Susie was not in the picture yet at this point. She's the one that wrote the book. She was born during the war. But this is them, and this is the family. Notice the smiles on their faces. I wish I could show you the picture of my grandmother that my Aunt Susie shared with me last year in May when my daughter and I, Daniela and I, visited her home. She has a picture of her mother before the war, as you see it here, and she has a picture of her mother immediately after the war. And you cannot imagine the contrast. My grandmother was in her 40s at the end of the war. She looks like she was in her late 50s, early 60s. The war aged her face and her features so much. And my grandmother, later in life, after the war, developed rheumatoid arthritis very seriously, which plagued her for the rest of her life until her death. So she was a very brave woman, and I'll share a very interesting story about her. To me, she's as much a hero of the family and of the book as my grandfather is. And if you've read the book, you know how it goes back and forth between the two. So anyway, those are my grandparents, and My father is no longer alive, but Kurt is alive. He will be 87 this year. He's a retired pastor and evangelist in Germany. And Lotte, as I said, is in Southern California. She worked as a in the Pacific Union office most of her life, working with HHES, with the literature evangelism work and so forth. Well, Hitler promised the world. Hitler promised the world to a Germany that was falling apart, had fallen apart. He promised everyone a Volksradio. Okay, a Volksradio. Maybe I need to translate. I don't need to translate that, do I? What is a folk? What's the word? F-O-L-K. Can you say that with me? Folk. We have that word in English, right? Folk. It's the same word in German with the V. Folk, but the V is pronounced like an F in German. So we say Volkswagen. How do you say it? I don't even know how you say it because I say it the German way.
Volkswagen.
Volkswagen. Okay? It's Volkswagen. The V is pronounced like an F in German, and the W is pronounced like a V in German. It's very confusing, and my aunt, who has lived in this country most of her life, still doesn't know how to... She says Volleyball. She doesn't know how to do the V properly. Anyway, it's interesting. But he promised everybody a Volksradio. What is a Volksradio? It's a radio of the people, for the people. And in those days, the radio was what your latest high-resolution 4K flat-screen television at Best Buy is, okay? That's what the radio was for that time. He promised everyone a job. He promised everyone a house, a Volkshaus. He promised everyone, well, I'm not sure about this, to be honest with you, but I wonder if he promised everyone a Volkswagen as well. Now, the only Volkswagen plant in the United States is in the town that I live in now, in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's a $1 billion green plant that was built just a few years ago. And it's interesting that it's built on the grounds of a munition storage facility with bunkers that used to house the bombs that were sent to Germany during World War II. So that's kind of ironic, isn't it? That Volkswagen now owns the property that once... Anyway, it's an interesting thing. But anyway, Hitler promised the world. He promised the world to Germany, and people began to believe him. He promised the world. He promised to bring Germany to greatness again, to bring Germany to its proper place in the theater of countries in the world. He is surrounded here by his chief lieutenants. Behind him on his left is Goebbels, the propaganda minister that used that radio that everyone got in their homes to deliver the message of Nazi propaganda. Did I just turn that off myself? Okay. And anyway, we could name all the people. The guy with the armband and the swastika around him, that's Heinrich Himmler. Heinrich Himmler was the chief architect of the Holocaust and of the Nazi death camps. And he was the one that he committed suicide at the end of the war. The guy that is right behind him on your left, that has half of his face cut off, that's Rudolf Hess, who was third in line to Hitler. But then in 1941, flew a Messerschmitt plane to England to try to negotiate some kind of deal with the British aristocracy at that time. And he was imprisoned, and he faced trial at the end in Nuremberg, and he remained in prison until just a few years ago when he died in Berlin in a prison. Anyway, these are some of the architects and the right hand, the guy that is standing out in the front because he has a coat that's colored differently than everybody else's. That is the head of the Luftwaffe, or the Air Force in Germany as well. Hitler's rise to power was a phenomenon that was taking Germany by storm, and it divided the country in a major way. It divided the church in a major way. Germany doesn't have a separation of church and state. In Germany, you have both the two state churches. You have Lutherans and you have Catholics. And of course, you have all the other churches as well, But the Adventist Church still today in Germany is not recognized as a church because we are not part of that system, and so we're kind of a sect in that part of the world. It's very interesting that there was a division even in the churches. We have people like Bonhoeffer, who stood up against the Nazi regime and the national churches, and we have others who didn't. Even within the Adventist Church, there was a divide. There were those who fully supported the new regime and others who had great skepticism about it. And my family were one of the skeptics and one of the individuals who did not go along. And I'll share with you a couple of stories as we move into this. Here's one of the posters that was very typical. Notice the word Volks. You see V-O-L-K-S? Volksgemeinschaft, that means people together. Unity. Okay? And NSDAP is the abbreviation for the Nazi Party, the National Socialist Democratic Workers Party. Okay? The A stands for workers, it's Arbeitspartei, and that was just another party. We have a two-party system here in this country, but in Germany still today there are multiple parties, and it's a coalition of those parties that then form a government in that particular country. And Hitler and his party won a huge number of seats, and they were able to move forward in that way. So here you see this was a masterpiece of showmanship. Those columns that you see going up into the air, this is Nuremberg, actually, in Germany, where the trials later were after the war was over. But this parade ground was the work of a young architect by the name of Albert Speer, or Speer, as you guys might pronounce it. He later wrote a very thick book about his experience with Hitler as the chief architect in the Nazi regime. But those columns that you see in the distance going up, they're actually spotlights. Okay, and just the ambiance of what was created here was quite impressive, with the flags and with everything else. I was speaking a few years ago at a camp meeting in the Carolina camp meeting, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, "Listen, I served at the very end of the war in Germany as an American soldier, and I have something that I think you would like to have." And I said, "Really? What is it?" He says, "I can't tell you. I'll send it to you." Okay, I forgot about it, actually, because you talk to a lot of people, you know, and a few weeks later, I received a small little package in the mail, a brown package, and I opened it up curiously. I didn't know who the person was because he didn't tell me what his name was, and so I opened it up, and there, folded in many different folds, I unfolded an original Nazi flag, just like the one that you see behind Hitler over there. I got goosebumps because those are illegal in Germany. You can't display a Nazi flag in Germany today. It's a symbol of hate and of oppression and of, many other things. Genocide. So I have it folded up, and I have it in my closet in that little package, and I keep it there. I didn't bring it this time because I don't want to show it here in church either. But anyway, it's an original. He picked it up right after the war. One people, one kingdom, one leader. Oh, it's translated there. You can also say one empire. Okay? So, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. Okay? And the U has two umlaut, two dots over it normally. So, one people, one empire, one leader. That was the common kind of slogan, if you will, of the German party during this time. And here you can see Hitler coming up the steps here. This is my grandfather's war passport. Wehrpass literally means war pass. He was part of the German army. In 1939, when Hitler invaded Poland, the draft was initiated, and my grandfather was 40 years old. He was born in 1899. 1939, he was 40 years old, and he was one of the first individuals to receive a draft notice. He was shocked because he was already 40. But he probably shouldn't have been shocked because he had served as a teenager in World War I. In the last year of World War I, he had served there. And because he already had experience in the war, he was called up. At the time, he was living in Frankfurt. He was a Seventh-day Adventist minister. He had several churches that he was in charge of, and he also was in charge of the literature evangelism work and training literature evangelists. So it was quite a shock to receive this notice to appear before the headquarters there and to receive his commission there. You can see his name at the top. This is the original. I scanned these in. My uncle has this, and I scanned this in, and here you can see it opened up, and there he is at 40 years of age. The information on the other side there, you can see, born the 3rd of May, 1899, in the city of Wangen, in the southern part of Germany. And you can see his father's name and his mother's name and what they did for a living. And you can see the official stamps on either side of his picture. And this is the list of the individuals. This is all documents that we have in the family. This is a list of the 1,200, not the whole list, but part of the list, of the 1,200 men in the unit that he was assigned to at the beginning of the war. Let me start with this story. When he arrived at the war office there in Frankfurt to be assigned his duty, he requested to be assigned a medical position as a medic. You see, as a minister, in World War I, he had not served as a Christian. He was not a converted Christian at that time. He was born and raised in a Catholic family, a nominally Catholic family. And later on in life, through a series of evangelistic meetings, he became a Seventh-day Adventist as a young man at the age of 20, right after the war. After that, he dedicated his life to serving the Lord, and he eventually became a literature evangelist and a minister. He became convicted throughout the years of studying Scripture and being a minister that he wanted to be a person to save life and not to take life. And so it was his conviction, a very difficult conviction in Germany at that time. He was, you could say, in our language today, a conscientious objector. He did not want to really serve in the war, and he certainly didn't want to take lives in the war. And so he asked specifically whether he could be assigned as a medic. But the officer that was assigning him that duty asked him a question. He says, "Why do you want to become a medic?" He says, "Well, because I'm a minister and I don't believe in taking lives. I believe in saving lives." He says, "Well, what would you do in this situation? You're treating a wounded soldier, one of your comrades, and over the hill comes an enemy towards you with a gun. Would you pick up the gun of the wounded soldier and defend him and kill the enemy that's coming towards you?" And my grandfather says, "No, sir." He says, "I'm convicted that I'm not here to take life. I'm here to save life. I will cover that wounded soldier's body with my own and protect him with my own body, but I will not take the life of another individual." He says, "We don't need cowards in the medical corps." And he wrote on the paper and he handed him his duty. Unit 699, you can see it on the top there, in the corner. Unit 699 was an engineering unit, a pioneer unit, 699, that was assigned to building bridges across the rivers so that the Germans could advance into the heart of Russia. They were first assigned in France with a French front, and then they were moving to Russia. That meant that my grandfather was on the very front lines, and he always believed, as he shared with us later, that that was done on purpose. They knew that the attrition rate at the front lines would be the highest, and they didn't want a coward in the army. They thought he would be taken away and killed very early on. So there you see my grandfather's name. He is registered here, Gefreiter, that's private. Later on, he received a rank of under officer. I don't know what the equivalent of that would be in the American system, but an under officer, literally Unteroffizier. I don't know how that would translate, but anyway, he went in as a private. You can see his address there, And you can see the rest of his comrades. I'll come back to this a little bit later tomorrow because we'll look at this. Here we have a group. I have a lot of pictures. I won't show them all today. But here they are in the Ukraine on their march. And this is an early shot. These shots were taken between 1939, 1940, 1941, and 1942. We found these actually just a few years ago. I was in my uncle's, in my cousin's home in Germany, and my uncle came over and he said, look, Uncle Kurt, my dad's older brother, he says, look what I just found when I moved from this city to the new city where I'm at right now. I found a box as I was moving. I didn't even know that I had this. And in this little box, about this big and about this big, I opened it up, and inside are 100 original photographs of the march into the heart of Russia. Now, this was found after my aunt published the book in 2001, so we could now publish another sequel maybe to it and add 100 photographs of that. My grandfather is standing right in the front there. And by the way, you can tell this is the beginning of the war because he has a little bit of weight on him there. You can tell that, can't you? He's getting a lot thinner as the years go by. Okay? In fact, we have the last piece of bread that my grandfather received before he was released at the end of the war in 1945. We have the piece of bread. It's not edible anymore, I don't think. I don't know that it was even edible then. It's black. It's become hardened with time. It's 70% sawdust. They didn't have a lot of flour. And they made their bread with 70% sawdust and some flour as well. I'd say they didn't have problems with, what do you say, fiber? No fiber problems. No need for Metamucil or anything like that. Okay, so that's my grandfather. And just some pictures. There he is now in the background. This is the same place, same scene with some of his friends or some of his colleagues. And this is where the story begins. So one day my grandfather came back from France. He had a home leave before he could go on and was reassigned to the Russian front. And he took off his uniform, put on civilian clothes, and went out with his wife shopping, and the boys, being boys and being fascinated with guns, as all boys are, decided to sneak into the bedroom and see and check out the uniform that Dad had just come home with from the war. And to check out, of course, the gun, which, of course, should have been locked up in a cabinet, right? But there were no cabinets, and it was just sitting there in a holster, just like this one. And so they went, and they looked. And just as they were at the position of pulling the gun out of the holster, Dad walked in. And he took hold of the scene. The boys were as shocked seeing him as they were shocked seeing what was coming out of the holster, because instead of pulling out that pistol that you see there, and by the way, I've looked up all of this and made sure that it's the right pistol, the right time period and all that. Instead of pulling out a pistol like this one, which was an officer's pistol that would have been issued at that time, they pulled out a wooden copy of that pistol, carved. And they looked at their dad, and the dad looked at them, and he says, boys, sit down right now. I need to talk with you. And they sat down. Of course, the boys were wide-eyed. They'd been caught in the act. They knew something was coming, but Dad just sat them down. He wasn't angry with them, but he was very serious. He says, boys, Kurt, Gat, you cannot ever tell anyone what you saw here today. Because if anybody knows what you saw here today, if anybody finds out what you saw here today, I will probably lose my life. An officer never gets rid of his weapon, but I did. He says, I was in France, and I made a decision. He says, I decided because I know, he says, I was in World War I, he says, and I know how to shoot. In fact, he was a sharpshooter in World War I. He was very good. He says, I know how to shoot. And he says, I know what it is to be in the heat of battle, and I know what it is to be in that situation, and I know what it is to be in that situation in the heat of battle, and to out of self-defense or whatever else, in the heat of the moment, it would be so easy to pull out that gun and use it. And I didn't want to ever be put in that position, so this is what I decided to do. I took my gun in a small French village, and I had a master woodcarver do an exact replica of it and paint it black, and I threw my pistol into the river. It's still there in France. And this is what I'm going to be carrying through the whole war. But boys, if anybody finds out about this, he says, I'll be court-martialed and I probably will be killed. An officer never gets rid of his weapon. Of course, you can see how the holster is, right? That was not difficult to conceal, and that's what my grandfather carried with him. As he was reassigned to the Russian front, Operation Barbarossa in 1941, you see there are three advances on the flank moving into the heart of Russia. My grandfather was in the southernmost flank, the one that moved south. Crossing over the Caucasus Mountains, over the Black Sea, their goal was the city of Baku, and their goal was the oil reserves. Baku still today is a huge oil city. The oil reserves that the Russians had there. Hitler knew that if he could capture the oil reserves of the Russians, he would not only cripple the Russians, but he would have the oil and the petroleum that he needed for his advance into Russia. And so that was their flank going south. And it was a major, major task. And those photographs that I showed you show that particular sequence of events as he continued to move through. This is what the Russians did to keep the Germans from advancing. They blew up their bridges. They blew up the train bridges. They blew up the regular bridges so that the vehicles, so that the men couldn't cross the rivers and go. So my grandfather's task, together with the other 1,200 men in his unit and other bridge building units, were to build pontoon bridges over the water. And depending on the size of the river, those pontoon bridges could be built overnight in a matter of 12 hours. So they would have boats, they would secure the opposite bank, and then they would build the pontoon bridge across. Some of these rivers were small, some of these rivers were large. That's my grandfather in the foreground there, you can see him, and that's a large river, isn't it? This is the Dnieper River in the Ukraine. And you can see the troops already going across, and I don't know if I have another picture here, no I don't. But later on, you'll see large vehicles, trucks and tanks moving across this as well. The pontoons are boats that are keeping it in place with ropes that are anchored down like this. This is one type of bridge that they built. They also built major bridges. This was an engineering unit. My grandfather was not an engineer. He was a pastor. He actually became the company clerk for Unit 699. He kept track of all the records. And that was why he had all these photographs. Most of the photographs and all of the records had to be destroyed at the end of the war. But we think he kept these because they have him in them. They were personal. So he kept them. And by the way, each of them is detailed with a description, a date on the back and a description on the back in his handwriting. And it's the old German script that I cannot read, even though I read German. My cousin, who grew up his entire life in Germany and has been a professor in Austria and Germany for many, many years, cannot read that script. We had to call my uncle, Kurt, my dad's older brother, over to help us read the script because he was trained in that old German script in school when he was a young boy. It's a lost way of writing today. And so he came over, and as he was translating it, I typed it out on my computer. I have it all there. It's German, but... Anyway, this is my grandfather. This is a shot down fighter plane, Russian fighter plane, that you can see the propellers kind of twisted up in the front, and they took a picture next to it. This is a funeral service of their unit. This was a frequent occurrence. And this is their march into the heart of Russia. My grandfather got a new pair of boots one day. They marched like this. They had a few vehicles. You can see a couple of vehicles. You can see horses, by the way, in the background as well. You can see they often had horse-drawn wagons as well. There were only one or two vehicles. And how many men did I say? 1,000 to 1,200 men in the unit. So this was a large unit. As they moved this way and marched this way, they would march 20 to 25 kilometers a day, all with heavy gear and everything else that they had with them. And my grandfather received these boots. Now, you know something about shoes and boots, right? The other day I went with my daughter and we bought some Vans. Tennis shoes, or not, they're skating shoes. And I got a pair because I wanted to feel young again, because I used to own a pair of Vans when I was young. And then I wore them when we were in Brazil just a few days ago. I wore them in Brazil and they hurt me because the back was just cutting into my skin. And I was like, I got to wear these things in, right? You got to wear new shoes in, right? Well, my grandfather had the same experience. These boots were hard boots. By the end of the day, of the first day marching in those boots, he could barely pull them off. His feet were so swollen. He hobbled with a friend of his to a river or a little creek nearby. As he put his feet into the water, he had blisters this size that were open, and his feet were a bloody mess. And he knew, as he pulled them out, he knew that they were swelling up. There was no way that he would be able to get them back in the next day, and there was no way he could continue on this journey like this. And he was sore. He was horribly depressed that day. And as he put his socks on and went back to the makeshift place where they were sleeping that night, he said a prayer to the Lord. He said, "Lord, I don't know how I'm going to make it tomorrow. You know that we have to march 25 kilometers a day, and you know that we are not able, there are no vehicles that I can ride on, and many of the other guys, you know, there's no way that I can make it. I cannot, if I'm not able to march 25 kilometers, I'm going to be left behind, and if I'm left behind, I could be captured by the Russians, and that's the most horrible thing that could happen. Lord, please do something to help me in this situation. I don't know what to do." He went to sleep with that thought. And the next morning, he woke up and he remembered the last thought that was in his mind, his feet. And as he woke up, he thought about his feet, and, you know, when you're waking up, you kind of maybe register what's going on down there with your feet. And he says, "I don't feel any pain." So then he pulled his leg up and felt it with his hand, still hadn't seen them. And he said, I don't feel any blisters or swelling. And he threw off his blankets and his feet were completely whole as if nothing had happened. There were no blisters. It was like they were baby feet straight out of. He was amazed. He put his boots back on. And he never had another problem with those boots as they continued to serve him through the war. Different pictures. On one of these pictures, and I don't have it here, he actually has a little arrow pointing out which one he is in the lineup here. By the way, this wasn't his camera. He didn't own a camera. He couldn't afford a camera. This was the camera that he was responsible for as the clerk of the unit to keep track and to keep that kind of thing. This is a picture he took of a courtyard of one of the villages. You see the Nazi sign in the background that it had been captured. He was also in charge of procuring food and buying food from the surrounding farmers for the people who were there. And it was in one of these, let me go back, it was in one of these places as they were in a schoolhouse sleeping one morning. My grandfather had prayed several days already. It was one of those times in his life, as the war had dragged on and on and on, Hitler had promised the war would be over in a very short period of a few months. But as the war dragged on and on and on, as they were moving deeper into the heart of Russia, Ukraine, and then Russia, my grandfather at one point felt a great feeling of despair. Am I ever going to make it home? Am I ever going to see my family again? How are they doing? Am I ever going to be able to... Are we ever going to get out of this alive? And he prayed to the Lord, and he didn't pray this very often. But on this particular occasion, after days of praying, he said, Lord, I know this is a lot to ask, and you normally don't do this, and you don't have to do this, but if you could give me some kind of a sign that I'm going to make it through this war, give me something. They were in a schoolhouse, their cots, not their cots, but their bedding, lined up like sardines in the schoolhouse. That's where they were sleeping in this particular village that they had captured some time before. And early in the morning, my grandfather was always an early riser, but early this morning, it was long before normal time to get up, he heard a distant sound, or at least he heard a sound. He didn't know what it was at first. It was kind of halfway between sleep and halfway between waking up. You've been there before, right? He heard a sound. What is that sound? Maybe it's a mosquito. No, it's not a mosquito. Now he's awake because he's been swatting and nothing's there. No, it's not inside the building. It's coming from outside the building. And he kind of recognizes the sound, but he doesn't know what the sound is. It's a strange, it's a... So he gets up. He carefully steps over the other soldiers that are with him there in the room. He opens the door. He goes out the door, crosses the street, where he climbs up a lookout tower that the Russians had built in this town. He climbs up the lookout tower, and he looks in the direction of the sound, and his heart stops. Coming over the hill towards that small village are dozens and dozens of Russian T-34 tanks. That's the sound. The sound of their engines as they're moving closer and closer. Dozens of them. He knows they're in one of those situations where they're behind enemy lines. They have only a few vehicles in their unit, only a few vehicles that are able to transport anything. And he knows that they have no match to meet that kind of onslaught. And so he said to me later, he says, I rushed down that lookout tower as fast as I could. I ran across the street. I flung open the doors and I said, get up, the Russians are coming. And he says, everybody jumped up. They grabbed what they could. They ran out the door. And just then my grandfather remembered that as the clerk, he was in charge of all of the secret code books. And in a closet just off from the... He had those in a small closet where there was a desk, and there they were. And he knew he didn't have time to gather them up. He knew he didn't have time to take them with him. And at that moment, what is he going to do? What is he going to do? And he prayed, Lord, Lord, if they get captured, if they get the code books, they're going to have all the codes of the German army. And I'm going to be blamed for that. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be court-martialed by my own people. What do I do? And at that moment, an idea came to him. So he grabbed a piece of chalk from the chalkboard in that schoolhouse. He took the door, closed it. He had the key. He locked it. And then he put a big skull and crossbones across the bottom. And he said, danger, do not enter. And he ran out the door, and everybody was gone. They'd left. They'd left him behind. They were gone. The last vehicle was pulling out. He could see it in the distance. He could see it pulling a heavy, heavy trailer behind it. Now I have to pause there because my aunt ruined the story when she wrote the book. I didn't read the book before it was published. She talked to me about it several times, but when it came out, the story that I'd heard from my grandfather and from my father was that a tank was pulling the trailer. Now, a tank for a boy is a very impressive machine. When my aunt published the book, it was a truck pulling the trailer. And a truck, while being impressive, is not as impressive as a tank. And the story, my favorite story growing up, was ruined just in that moment. And it bothered me for years. And finally, I was in Germany, and I asked my Uncle Kurt, the oldest, who actually was alive and heard these stories too. My father had already passed away. I asked my Uncle Kurt, I said, "Kurt, tell me, was it a tank or was it a truck? How could Tante Susie do this?" He said, "She was right." And I said, "No, it was a truck." He says, "It was. But your father was right too. It was a tank." And I looked at him, I said, "Come on. My dad couldn't have been right and say it was a tank, and she was right as well and say it was a truck." He said, "Here, let me show you." And he pulled out a magazine that he had, and I had to take a picture of it. That's the magazine he showed me with this. This is a model, but that's what was pulling it in the front. You see it? It's a half track. It's got the tracks of a tank and the wheels of a truck in the front. He says, "That's what it was." I said, "Okay. All right. But that doesn't have a gun on it like the tanks did." He says, "Well, some of the half tracks had a gun on mounted on it as well, and that one probably did." I said, "Okay. Well, at least it's pulling a tank." He says, "Well, it wasn't pulling a tank." I said, "What do you mean it wasn't pulling a tank?" He says, "It was pulling the lumber that they were building the bridges with." I said, "Oh. So, okay. It was pulling a trailer, and it was a tank truck." The story is kind of half rescued at this point, okay? But this is what it was. And my grandfather knew that in order to be rescued that day and not fall and be trapped with the Russians and be captured by the Russians, which was the most horrible thing that a German could imagine, he knew he had to make it to that vehicle. And he ran. He told me later, he says, "Michael, it was about 100 meters away." And he said, "I know that day I beat all the records of all the Olympian runners for the 100 meter dash." I said, "Grandpa, come on, how do you know?" He says, "Because they're just running for a medal. I ran for my life." I said, "Okay, all right, that's your opinion, that's fine." So he says, I ran for everything I was worth. I ran, but I didn't quite make it. I made it to the hitch that connected the trailer, I'm just going to say it, to the tank truck, the half track. By the way, there were thousands of these half tracks that were made. They were very, very important vehicles during the Second World War. He says, "I made it to the hitch." You see the hitch there, right? He says, "And I sat down on the hitch." He says, "I was out of breath. I was catching my breath as I was sitting there. And just at that moment, there was a sharp curve." Isn't this picture perfect? My uncle, he got the perfect picture. He says, "There was a sharp curve," he says, "and they took that curve, and I didn't see it coming," he says. "I was regaining my breath," he says, "and I lost my balance, and I fell back off the hitch on my back. And as I turned my head, all I could see was the heavy wheel of that trailer heading straight for my head. And I knew at that moment that it was over." In fact, he says, "I don't know. People have had these near-death experiences." He says, "This is an experience I had." He says, "I saw my whole life flash before my eyes from when I was a child all the way to that moment in time. Like a giant movie," he said. "It was all there." And he says, "Then I had only the chance to say in my mind, 'Lord, save me and my family.' And at that moment," he said, "I felt someone grab me on my collar, yank me up from underneath that trailer and that hitch, lift me up high in the air, and place me on the top of that tank truck." Now, it wasn't open like this. This is a convertible tank truck, okay? This one was a closed one. So they put me on top of the roof of the truck. Well, they didn't say truck, but you know. And he says, "There I sat, still out of breath, from the run I had a few seconds ago, out of breath because I fell on my back, had the wind knocked out of me." And he says, "There I'm sitting on there." And he says, "I look around to see who to thank, and there's nobody to be seen. When I stuck my head down to the compartment where the driver was sitting, They were so shocked to see me. Havel, what are you doing up there? He says, I know without a matter of a doubt that an angel plucked me from underneath that place and placed me on top of that vehicle. The angel of the Lord saved my life that day. He says, I have no question, no doubt. Well, that was my favorite story, one of my favorite stories growing up. When we were kids, we used to crawl into Dad and Mom's bed on Sunday morning, and we would tell us World War II stories. And that was one. So some of the details may differ a little bit from the book, because a book, you know, you have to fit everything in there. There are stories in the book that I never heard growing up, and there are some stories that I heard that are not in the book. Maybe I'll share one of those. Do I do children's story tomorrow? No, I won't put the pastor on the spot. Anyway, there's a good one. There's another good one. If I have time tonight. Be still and know that I am God. My grandfather had his prayer answered that day. God gave him an unmistakable sign that stayed with him throughout the rest of the years of the war. My grandfather knew that no matter what happened, he could be still and know that there was a God who cared. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. I want to switch next to my grandmother. Tell you a story of my grandmother's side of the family. Because while my grandfather was in, I shouldn't say the side of the family, they're all the same family, but my grandfather, while he was on the Russian front, my grandmother was at home alone with three children, later four, when Susie was born at the end of the war. She had her own challenges, major challenges. A few years ago, at a camp meeting where I was speaking, one of my distant relatives came and also was there. He was also a World War II survivor. I always knew him growing up as Uncle Willy, but he's actually related not by blood, but through marriage. But he grew up across the block from where I grew up, across the farm from where I grew up in Michigan. And his son, David, was my best friend growing up. He's a pilot for Walmart Corporation now, corporate pilot. And Uncle Willy asked me as we were walking around Lake Junaluska, he said to me, Michael, what do you think I wished for more than anything else during the war as a child? What do you think I wished for more than anything else? He made me guess for 45 minutes. Was the whole walk around the lake. It was exasperating. I started, toys? No. No, didn't want toys. Food? No. World peace? You know, I came up with all kinds of, no, not really, I want specifics, he said. All right. So I kept guessing and guessing and guessing. Finally I said, Uncle Willy, you can have me doing this. I won't guess. He says, no, you probably wouldn't guess because it was a very basic thing. He says, the thing that I wanted more, and I want your children to listen that are here today, the thing that I wanted more than anything else was to have one quiet, uninterrupted night of sleep without an air raid siren going off and bombs dropping. That's what I wished for more than anything else. My dad grew up in Frankfurt, Germany, before they were evacuated as a family to a rural country village called Eschenroth. That's where they lived. And the air raids were incessant. My dad knew. He was 10 years old when the war ended. He knew how to identify the planes by the sound of their engines. He said, I knew if they were British, I knew if they were American, I knew what kind of plane it was, I knew if it was a bomber, I knew if it was a fighter jet, or not a jet, but a fighter plane. I knew. He said, Dad, how did you know that? Was it a hobby? He says, no, it was survival. You had to know what was going on overhead. They lived in an apartment building on the outskirts of Frankfurt. And I've got time. Pastor said I could go till 8 o'clock. Is that okay? This is a story that's not in the book. They were living on the outskirts of Frankfurt, and when the bombs came down, they would blanket certain portions of the city. There would be lights that would go up. They called them Christmas trees because they were kind of triangular shaped. They would drop these flares that would light up the target area for the bombs to drop. And this particular time, there was an air raid siren that went off. My dad always slept with his clothes on every night. He knew, didn't know when it was going to happen that, you know, an air raid would go off. Danielle and I had an experience just a couple summers ago. We were in Israel excavating in 2014 when the Gaza-Israeli war started. And we were in southern Israel, 20 kilometers away from Gaza. And we experienced air raid sirens for the first time at 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And we slept with our clothes on as the rockets from Gaza came flying overhead and the Patriot missiles intercepted them. But we learned later that the Patriot missiles only intercepted the ones that were heading to areas of urban areas where there were populations. If they knew that they were going into a field, they would let them go. That was a little disconcerting. So anyway, we hear the air raid sirens, and we knew we had 45 seconds. We had 45 seconds, Danielle and I, and the rest of the team that were there, we had 45 seconds to reach the bunker. 45 seconds. That sounds like very short, but it actually, when you're running or walking and getting up and going, it's quite a bit of time. We made it every time. Our bunker wasn't in our building. We had to cross the lawn. It was sprinkling a couple times, wasn't it? Didn't they have the sprinklers on a few times? We had to go through sprinklers. Not that that mattered. And we went to the bunkers, and then we sat there, or stood there, and waited until we could hear the explosion. And after the explosion was over, we knew that the danger was over and we could go back to sleep. And then an hour or two later, the sirens would go off again. My dad slept with his clothes on. They had an air raid shelter in the basement of their building, but it was a basement air raid shelter. It wasn't really designed to withhold a direct hit. There were three things in the air raid shelter. There was a pile of sand, there were buckets of water, and there were piles of blankets. The blankets were there not for people to keep warm, but if there was a direct hit or a hit that would cause a fire, they would put the blankets into the water. They would cover themselves with the wet blankets and try to get out of the building with minimal burning. My dad also said that they couldn't hold their breath during these air raids. He says they would sit there with their ears plugged like this, looking at each other and breathing and making sure that they were breathing. Because if the impact was too close, the impact, if they were holding their breath, could do damage to their lungs. I'm a diver, and so it's kind of the principle of when you're way down deep and you don't hold your breath when you're coming to the surface because the air expands and you do damage to your lungs. So anyway, he said that's what we would do. He says one day, there was an air raid, the sirens, the air raid sirens back then, went like this. There was the air raid siren that gave you a longer period of time to make it to the air raid shelter, and then there was a shorter period of time. The longer period of time, the one that you had quite a bit of time to get to the air raid shelter, sounded like this. And he says, when that siren, you knew you could take your time to get to the air raid shelter. But he says, there was the short siren. He says, and you had to get to an air raid shelter immediately. Sometimes they weren't on top. Sometimes there was a surprise. He says, and that siren went like this. He says, man, that was a scary one. So they slept with their clothes on and they went, sometimes they slept in the bunkers actually. But on this occasion, he says, they went down. They knew that the target area was further off. They heard the bombs dropping further off, but then they heard another sound. They heard the sound of a plane that was descending with an engine it had been hit and it was sputtering and it was kind of catching on and off and it was coming down. And what does a bomber do when it comes down for a crash landing? He has to drop all of its bombs. You don't want to crash land with a belly full of bombs, right? So as he was coming down and he was heading straight towards them, he was dropping his payload. The bombs, Dad would describe, sounded something like this. Silence. Boom! And then you had the impact. So they would come by intervals. The reason he was heading towards them, they were on the outskirts of the city, kind of the last building of the city. Behind them was a wide open field, and behind that field, there was a small airport, but he wasn't going for the airport, he was going for the field. And as he was coming in, the bombs were going, and Kurt and my dad were looking at each other. They were counting with wide eyes, they were counting the intervals of those bombs coming down and trying to figure out which one, and if there could be one that would hit them directly, what would happen. They were praying too. And just as they calculated the bomb would drop that would either hit them directly or land right next to them, just as they braced for that impact, they were thrown across the room. But as they opened their eyes, everybody was still there and everything was okay. They heard the plane land and there was silence. And he got up. They all got up. They went outside. What was the impact and why was there no explosion? They went around the building. And just a few, 2 or 3 meters, 4 meters away from the wall of that, from the wall where they were, that basement, that side of the building where they were, just a few meters away was a gaping open hole. And inside the hole was a bomb that had not detonated. Now, I don't know if you know this, but still today in German cities like Berlin and Hamburger. That's where the word hamburger comes from, by the way. Frankfurter, by the way, it also comes from the city where my dad's from, you know. Anyway, besides the point. Bad inventions of the Germans. Anyway, so what they did, they went around. Oh, what I was going to say is, still when they build buildings in these cities, they still find duds. They find bombs that haven't exploded. Still find them when they put in, you know, subway systems or whatnot. Still have to bring bomb crews. And so a bomb squad came to this location. Everybody was told to evacuate the area. This bomb was brought carefully out, it was placed off to the side, and it was opened up and diffused. And my dad and his brother Kurt came back immediately to see what was happening. They talked to the guys. So what happened here? How come that bomb didn't go off? Tell us what happened. And the guy said, well, we've diffused a lot of bombs. There are duds. They happen. But this wasn't a dud. This bomb should have gone off. But something very strange we've never seen before. In the detonator, between the pin and the detonator, there's a pin there. When that pin hits, that detonates the bomb. There was a piece of paper that was folded into 4 parts and stuck right in that crucial place. That's why the bomb didn't go off. And my dad looked at his brother, and Kurt looked at his brother, Gat. What? Yep, we've never seen it before. Well, how did it get there? You know, boys are asking the questions. We don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Who put it there? Well, we didn't put it there. Somebody else put it there. And over the years, I've come up with all kinds of grand theories about how that piece of paper got there. I wonder if, as the bomb was coming down, you know, an angel like Superman flies there, unscrews it, puts the paper. No, that doesn't make sense. He could have just pushed it off and let it land somewhere in a field someplace, right? Maybe a lady, and it was primarily women in this country that were building these bombs, because the men were off at war, right? Many women were building. Maybe a lady didn't want that bomb to go off months earlier when that bomb was built and put a piece of paper in that strategic location. I don't know. But my dad and his family, my grandmother, were convinced that the Lord had answered their prayer. One day there was a loud knock on the door of that of their apartment there in Frankfurt. Kurt, the oldest, went to open the door, and there stood a fine-looking gentleman in a beautiful civilian suit, clean-cut, sharp. My uncle noticed two things about him. My uncle, by the way, was 15 years old when the war ended, so he was maybe about 13 or 14. He noticed two things about him. He noticed that in his lapel was a beautiful gold pin with a swastika on it. It looked something like this. This is an original, by the way. The official pin of the Nazi Party. This man was a member of the Nazi Party. But he also noticed that around his arm was an armband with the same three colors of red and white and black with also a swastika on it. That's that strange cross that you see there. And the man was very polite. He says, "Hello, is your mother at home?" He said, "Yes. Could I please see her?" So he was ushered in. The children were told to go back to the kitchen, and my grandmother had a meeting with this member of the Nazi Party. After he left, my grandmother came into the kitchen to talk to her children. She gathered them around and she says, "Children, we really need to pray now. The gentleman that just came has given us an official invitation to join the Nazi Party." Now you have to understand something. In this country, I can decide whether I want to be a Democrat, whether I want to be a Republican, whether I want to be a Libertarian, whether I want to be an Independent. I can choose what I want to do and who I want to vote for. We all made that decision a few months ago. But in Germany, you could not simply choose to be a member of the Nazi Party at this junction in time. You had to be invited to join. And if you were invited to join, it was considered a great and distinct privilege because it was the party, the ruling party. It was not only considered a great privilege, it meant that you would receive twice as many rations as the rest of the German population. That meant if you had children that instead of receiving one pair of shoes a year, you received two pairs of shoes a year. And when little boys' feet grow as rapidly as they do some years, my dad said it became very uncomfortable for him some years. They almost had to cut the front of the shoe off to allow his toes to continue to grow. You were invited to all of the social events in the city, to the opera, to various concerts, to banquets. You were part of the elite. That was the one side of it. To refuse to join the Nazi Party, if you were invited, was a sign of treason. And you didn't dare to do that. So my grandmother, my father's mother, found herself in a very precarious situation. She said, "Children, this is what I did. I told the gentleman that on important decisions, your father and I have a policy in our home. We do not make important decisions independently. We make important decisions together. As a husband and wife, we make those together. Because your father is on the Russian front, I told this gentleman that I needed to write to him and consult with him over this matter. Children, you know that this only has bought us a little bit of time." Now, back then there was no FedEx and no DHL, and letters to get to the Russian front would take a long time and letters to get back would take a long time. So there was some time, but it was just a time-saving device. My grandmother did that the next day. She wrote a letter to her husband, and then she waited. When the first months passed, there was no check from the government at the beginning of the next month. the check didn't arrive. Her husband was serving in the German army, but the check that supported his family didn't arrive. And the ration cards didn't arrive. When the second month came, I'm sorry, let me back up. On a Wednesday evening prayer meeting, my grandmother shared her prayer request to the church. She said, "This is the situation. Our ration cards didn't arrive. Our money didn't arrive. I don't have money to buy food for the next month. I don't have the means to do that." There was a very dear lady, her and her elderly husband, who was too old to join the army or be drafted into the army, owned a small grocery store, and Sister Geisler and her husband came to her after the prayer meeting and said, "We will take care of you this month. We will give you money and we will give you food." The problem was, without the ration cards, it was difficult to buy things, so they were going to help on both accounts. When the end of the second month came, there was still no ration cards and there was no check in the mail. Sister Geisler and her husband helped again. Third month, no ration cards, no check. No answer from the Russian front. When the fourth month arrived, my grandmother became very frustrated. You can imagine. Three children to feed at home. I don't know if there were four by this time or not. She wrote a very pointed letter to her husband, a second letter that was addressed to him on the Russian front. And in that letter, she said, "I don't understand." She says, "You are serving your country, but I am here at home and the government is not supporting your family at home. And I am very, very concerned. I don't know how we will continue to survive." Because you see, that week, Mrs. Geisler had told my grandmother, that she didn't have any more savings left. There was no more money. And she wasn't able to help them any longer. The next day, there was a loud knock on the door. Another man stood there with a very fine civilian suit with the same emblems that I described before. It was not the same man. He simply handed Kurt this time a letter. And he said, "Please give this to your mother." Kurt gave it to his mom. The man left. And as my grandmother opened it up, her face went white. It was a summons to the party headquarters in the city of Frankfurt, also known as the Gestapo headquarters, the secret police. It was known as a place that when people were summoned there, they usually didn't return. So my grandmother called the children into the living room. They prayed together, and my grandmother said, "Look, this is the plan." She had worked out a plan. She said, each of you will be told to go to different places if I don't return. She says, "You're not going to be put in Nazi schools. They have special schools where orphan children go, and you're not going to be made into good Nazis." She says, I've made arrangements. Each of you are going to separate places. I will designate specifically where those places will be, and none of you will discuss with each other where you're going. If one of you is caught, I do not want the other one or the person who's caught to be tempted to lie and not tell the whereabouts of their sibling. So I don't want to tell you where you're going to. I want you not to know where you're going to. And I'm going to make separate arrangements. I'm going to tell each of you where you're going, but you're not to discuss this with each other. And I've made these arrangements very carefully, and you are to follow my instructions to the letter. Do you understand? And they all, with wide eyes, nodded their heads. They understood. Now you have to imagine, my father was the youngest at this time, and he was probably about 7 or 8. When the day arrived for her appointment, the children did not go to school. They were instructed to stay at home. The sheer curtains were closed. Nobody was to know that they were home. In fact, the children were told to be very quiet because there was a family in their apartment complex, the Hallebachs, that were known to be members of the Nazi party, and they spied on everybody else and were informants for the entire complex. So my grandmother said, you're to stay at home, you're to be very, very quiet. If I do not return, and I'm just going to make the number up because I don't remember exactly what time it was, but if I do not return by noon, she said, this is what's going to happen. Each of you in 5-minute increments are going to leave and you're going to go where I tell you. So they were each called into the kitchen and they were told their directions. When Kurt came out of the kitchen, the youngest, my dad, said, Kurt, where are you going? What did Mom tell you? He says, I can't tell you. It's a secret. We're not to tell each other. But I want to know, Kurt. You have to tell me. Nope. Lotte, you're next. You go in next. So Lotte went in. She got hers. She came out. Lotte, you have to tell me. Please, you're my older sister. Nope, not telling you. You're next. Dad, go in. So my dad went in. He was told to take two different streetcars to this stop, then a streetcar here, and at this stop over here. Your Aunt Anna is going to pick you up and take you into the country to stay with some Adventist family there. The children waited. The hours ticked by. It was 9:00. They looked through the sheer curtains. They could see where the streetcar stopped. They knew that that was the streetcar that their mother would be on when she came home. So they watched every single streetcar that stopped there. They couldn't quite see the streetcar. They could, because there was a tree blocking the view from their apartment, but they were able to see the bottom part of the streetcar. And they looked and they looked and they looked, but the hours ticked by, and every 15 minutes the streetcars would come, but there was no mother. 11:15, by noon they had to leave. 11:15, no mother. 11:30, no mother. 11:45, only two streetcars left. 11:45, no mother. At 12:00, they knew it was the last one before they would have to go off in their separate. And they all looked at each other and they prayed again. And as that 12:00 streetcar arrived, they noticed one set of legs moving faster than all the others underneath that tree. And if you know anything about mothers and children, you know that children recognize their mother's walk, don't they? And they say, it's mother! It's mother! She's home! Shh! The Hallebachs upstairs, they can't know that we're here. And mother came in, and there were hugs, and there were kisses, and there were tears of joy. And then my grandmother sat the children down. She says, I have to tell you what happened this morning. You know, my appointment was for this morning, early. When I arrived at the building, oh, and by the way, the children had heard rumors at school already about this building, the party headquarters. They heard rumors that because people didn't return from those buildings, that there were handles to go in the doors, but no handles to come out. This is a children's story. You know? They'd heard that. So there, they had told Mother that before she went. They'd warned her before she went that there might not be handles on the inside, you know, leading out. I think I have some slides. Oh, that's the building. Actually, no. This is the building. This is the equivalent building in Munich, Germany. Okay? This is the equivalent building. This is the Nazi headquarters in Munich, Germany. I just put this picture here. I don't know who she met with that day in terms of his rank, and I just put this picture here for effect. How's that? You see the paneling on the back wall, though? That's interesting, because this is what my grandmother said. Listen to the story. She says, I waited in the outer waiting area for hours. I kept looking at the watch. I was so worried about you because I knew our decision about you leaving at noon, but I waited there for hours. I asked the receptionist several times, and she said, I'm sorry, you have to wait. Finally, she said, finally, I was ushered in to the office. You see, she had an appointment with the director of the Gestapo there, the director of that building. It would be like the equivalent, I don't know. You have a big city called Sacramento close by, right? It's like meeting with the director of the police, maybe at Sacramento, not the director, the chief of police, or the chief of police of Atlanta, except this is not a, these are not good police. These are the Gestapo. These are the secret police. So she says, I arrived and I was ushered into this office. She said, it was the most beautiful office I'd ever seen. There were Persian carpets piled on top of each other on the floor, she said. There was mahogany. You see the paneling behind here? It's just my imagination. I just got this off the internet. But there was paneling, she says, mahogany paneling, wood all around the office. She says there were masters, paintings of the masters, originals on the walls. And she said behind a huge mahogany desk sat a man. And when I walked in, he stood up. He greeted me very formally. And he said, Frau Hazel, please take a seat. But she said, I refuse to sit. I said, no, thank you. I'll remain standing. He says, fine. He says, Frau Hazel, do you know why you're here today? And my grandmother said, children, honesty is always a good thing. And at this point, there was no reason to play games. So I said, I think I do. She said, several months ago, I was invited to join the Nazi party. Yes, precisely. He says, are you aware, he says, that the Nazi party, what it offers you? She said, yes. Why would you refuse to join the Nazi party? Why would you refuse to join a party that has given so much to this country? Why would you refuse to join a party that has given hope and a future to this country? And as he spoke, he became more animated and more excited, and his veins in his neck started popping out. And he said, why would you do such a thing? And then he opened up in front of her a file, and he pulled out two letters. The very two letters that she had sent to her husband. One a couple of days before, and the other one months before. He says, and you write what you wrote in these letters? Are you trying to discourage the troops on the front lines by telling them that their government is not taking care of them at home? She said, sir, I have just told them the truth. He said, who are you and why do you defy the party? And why do you refuse to join? And as he paused just for a moment, she was able to finally get a word in edgewise. And she said, sir, it's very simple. She says, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist Christian. And as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, I believe that there is a God in heaven. And because I believe that there is a God in heaven, I cannot join a party that is based on principles as if that God does not exist. I cannot do that conscientiously. I must be faithful to my Heavenly Father. And he looked at her and he said, who did you say you were? He says, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist Christian. Yes, yes, I thought I heard that. What church do you attend? And she told him the church that she attended. And he said, I see. Just a moment. And he picked up a phone on his desk. Now, in my mind's imagination, I'm making this completely up. I have an idea that there were five phones on his desk and that he picked up the red phone. But that's my imagination. I'm just telling you that. He picked up the phone on his desk and he says, please check if Hilda Hazel, if Helena Hazel is a member of such and such a church. He hung up. They stared at each other. 2 minutes later, the phone rang. Yes? Uh-huh. I understand. Thank you very much. So, you're a member of that church. Very good. Do you know the Miller family? Now, my grandmother became very cautious because the last thing she wanted to do was become an informant on some of her fellow church members. But she had noticed in the intervening moments as they were having this dialogue together that the anger had drained out of his face, that he was almost smiling now, and it wasn't a sadistic smile, it was actually a friendly smile. And so she thought that she might take a risk. And she said, yes, actually I do. Herr Müller is our head elder and has been serving as our pastor while our pastor has been away, which happens to be my husband. I see. Well, I happen to know the Müller family as well. Now my grandmother was very surprised. She says, "You do?" "Yes. My wife and I have just moved into a brand new neighborhood. We've just moved into a new house. It's a beautiful neighborhood and we love our neighborhood, but what we love more than anything else is our new neighbors, the Müller family. They have been the most hospitable, most wonderful neighbors that we have ever experienced in our lives. They have brought fresh baked bread to our home. They've invited us over for dinner. They have been wonderful neighbors. We've never had friendly neighbors like this in our lives. They have become good friends. And they're Seventh-day Adventists, I know. And you're a Seventh-day Adventist. Interesting." Now my grandmother was smiling. A big smile. And he was smiling even bigger. And he looked down at his desk and he closed the file. And he said, "I'm sorry that we disturbed you today. You're free to go. But furthermore, I want you to know that the payments will be coming to you, not only the one for this month, but all the preceding 4 months. You will have those all restored to you, as well as the ration cards. And Mrs. Hazel, I want to assure you that you will not be disturbed by this office again. Have a good day." As my grandmother turned to walk to the door, which, by the way, had a handle on the inside, he said, "Oh, by the way, Mrs. Hazel, I need to tell you something before you leave. I'm not the director that you were scheduled to meet with today. I'm so sorry for the long delay and your wait outside. I happen to be the deputy director for this office. The director became violently ill this morning and has not been able to come to work today. But I want to assure you that in this matter I have full authority and you will not be disturbed again. Have a very good day." My grandmother not only was never disturbed again by Gestapo headquarters, not only were those checks and those ration cards returned, but she survived the devastation of the Second World War. And I knew her when she was in her 80s. We would visit Germany every 2 or 3 years to visit my grandparents, who never immigrated to the United States, who remained there. My grandfather, when he retired, was the publishing director for the Central European Division, which was covering all of Central Europe. In 1966, he retired. My grandmother, when I knew her as a young boy, she walked with a walker. Her hands were all twisted with rheumatoid arthritis. She could barely make it to the bathroom and back to her bed. On very special occasions, she would join us in the kitchen for dinner. Later in life, I knew her only as a bedridden individual, wasting away from this terrible disease. But she always had a smile on her face. And she wrote poetry. In her lifetime, she wrote over 1,000 poems. She wrote them about her grandkids. She wrote a poem once about me watering the flowers out on the porch. You know, Germans like to have flowers on the porch, right? And how I showered the neighbors downstairs with the water. She included that in a poem. She wrote many poems. My grandmother suffered a great deal during the war and after the war. But she always praised God for what he did, not only in the war, but how he was her redeemer later in life as well. But for today, I just want to share with you that in the devastation that we see here, it's quite remarkable. I want to share with you a comment that is very shocking for Americans to hear. I'm an American born in this country. I'm proud to be an American. This country gave my family a place when they didn't have a home anymore. My mother was a refugee who grew up in Yugoslavia and was forced to leave that country when Germany lost the war. And she was a refugee in Austria for 7 years, living in a chicken coop with her siblings and with my grandmother. They became Adventists there, and it was the village church in Berrien Springs that sponsored them to come to the United States. I'm very thankful to this country that gave my family opportunities that we would not have had otherwise. When 9/11 happened, and my youngest daughter was just, I think, less than a year old, I think Daniela will maybe remember watching it on TV or something like that when we went to the neighbors, because we don't have a TV. But when that happened, my aunt, who lives in this country and immigrated to this country, not the aunt from this side of the family, but from my mother's side of the family, made this comment that was very shocking to me. She said this, and I just want to share this with you because it's shocking still, and I want to just share it with you, not to minimize anything, but to compare the devastation that was felt here compared to what was felt in New York. She said to me, she says, that was nothing about 9/11. I said, Tanta Mary, you cannot say that out loud anywhere. I know, she said. But she says, it's true, it was nothing. She says, that was one building or maybe two. She says, for us, it was entire cities that were destroyed. In one night of bombing in Hamburg, Germany, in Hamburg, the industrial capital of Germany in the north, in one night of bombing, 20,000 civilians died. They called it the Hiroshima or the Nagasaki of Germany. It was a devastating time, but in moments like this, in moments of crisis, what my family experienced was the reality that they served a living God that is still high and lifted up, seated upon his throne, and is still watching. And my comment this evening would be this, that God still exists today, and he is as faithful today as he has always been. And no matter what we face in our lives, no matter what devastation we may face in our lives, whether it's an illness or whether it's financial, that God is powerful. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Heavenly Father, we are living at the end of Earth's history. Things that happened 70 years ago in Germany can happen again. And I pray that you would keep us close to your word. Keep us focused on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And may your word not return to us void and empty, but may it continue to live in our lives and as we share that with others. I thank you for the Miller family today, for being the neighbors that they were, because without them, I wouldn't be here today. I thank you for my grandmother, who was courageous enough to state who she was and who she believed in to the highest authority in her city. And I thank you for my grandfather, who faithfully served you for 6 years in a war with a wooden gun, and you were faithful to him. Be faithful to us, Lord, today. Thank you for your promises in Matthew chapter 28. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.